The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
In 5, 4, 3, 2. Welcome back to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am one of your hosts for the day, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
I'm Jody Green from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
And I am Michael Scavarla with Penn State University.
And we have a very special guest with us here today. Very special guest. Would you mind introducing yourself to the Arthropod crowd?
Yeah, I'm Dr. Jovan Hill, director of the Mississippi Entomological Museum and an assistant professor in the Department of Biochemistry, Molecular Biology, Entomology, and Plant Pathology.
Here. That is a mouthful. I don't know how you print business cards down there.
It's multiple lines.
Well, welcome to the show. We're very happy to have you. It's exciting to have somebody that can talk us through maybe some grasshopper taxonomy. We'd also love to hear more about the bugs in Mississippi State and the Mississippi Entomology Museum. But welcome aboard. We're happy to have you.
Yeah, glad to be here.
So John mentioned grasshoppers just now, and we have spent two episodes talking about Rocky Mountain locusts. So before we talk about some of your other grasshopper work, I would like to pick your brain about Rocky Mountain locusts, if we could, for a bit. The book that we read, Locust, came out 20 years ago or so. I'm sure you're familiar with it. What are your opinions about the tale that Jeffrey Lockwood spun in his book? Have there been any updates to what we know about Rocky Mountain locust in the last 20 years? You know, we talked about this book because, well, frankly, I really like Rocky Mountain locusts, but I don't really have much of a conception of, you know, how accurate it is or what the general consensus among Orthoptera experts is. So I know it's kind of a broad ask.
We'll see. I'll try to hone in on it some. So in terms of the book, you know, it had been quite a while since I'd read it when y'all asked me to be on the podcast. And I remembered it as, you know, an entertaining, good book. Probably read it when I was a master's student, maybe something like that. And, you know, it's an intriguing tale. I did pick it back up and refresh myself on it in preparation for this. And, you know, I found it to be a little diverging at times. There was a lot of asides, I felt, but still, it was still, as an entomologist, interesting historical information and whatnot. And I don't know if y'all have delved into any of Lockwood's papers. He had a lot of sort of in literature battles with Ted Cohn, who he actually acknowledges in the front of the book, but about the value of genitalia in species delimitation in melanoplans or in grasshoppers. And so I knew him mostly from that to start with. And that all spun out of this Rocky Mountain locust work. But in the end, he and Ted became friends and came to a consensus. So that was cool. I've never interacted with Lockwood, but other than an email I sent to him after I read the book. And I asked him about sort of that last little bit of the book about where he thought he saw some in Yellowstone or whatever. And he ignored that part of my email, but sort of commiserated with me doing field work in the South because he got his degrees at LSU. So, yeah. But, I mean, I thought it was a good book. And, I mean, he did a lot to synthesize what we know about the Rocky Mountain locust, I thought, in that book.
That's a unique way of making friends as an adult. I've never heard that, bonding over the genitalia of grasshoppers.
Oh, I do it all the time.
Just real brief, because we didn't go into the scientific literature behind it. What was the argument that Rocky Mountain locust was sanguipedes or the genitalia were different?
Right, yeah. So there was some of that. Yeah. And then that's been an argument. I think it even comes up in the book that previous people had that Spreetus was actually just a migratory or a locust phase of sanguinipedes. And so there was some of that. But in melanoplans, especially melanopus, the genitalia are what we go by for species delimitation. They don't have many pre-copulatory sort of species delimitation factors. And so, you know, it's pretty much that the genitalia fit that old lock and key sort of idea. And so, and it, that's been held up through a lot of molecular work as well, or supported. And so, it kind of all ties back to that. And Cone was like, hey, these genitalia are different. And they were just little sort of editorial articles. And I think they were in the Journal of Orthoptera Research back years ago.
So just to confirm, like with genitalia and DNA and all of it, recommended locust was a distinct species. Where that's consensus at this point?
Well, so...
Oh, no.
So genitalia, yes. Back in the late 50s, early 60s, somewhere in there, Ashley Gurney, who was curator of Orthoptera at the Smithsonian, did a revision of the Sanguinipes species group and pretty much illustrated the genitalia and all the other species and said, yeah, Spreedus is a valid species. Molecularly, there actually hasn't been much done other than back maybe in the late 90s or 2000s, somewhere there. Bill Chapko from Canada did some. And of course, that was early, you know, sort of molecular work we were doing then. And I think he had it as valid as well. They're sort of on the horizon. So I have the Smithsonian melanoplan collection here at Mississippi State on long-term loan. And so I have, like, it's really cool. I have Riley's specimens that he worked with. There are trays of nymphs at different instars all laid out that and stuff he did all these, you know, all of his illustrations and stuff from. In preparation for this, I was pulling out specimens yesterday and just looking at them. And then there was some collected by Thomas. And, you know, having just refreshed myself on the book, that was really cool. It's like, wow, I'm holding the specimen.
Yeah,
that's really cool.
And so, and then also, you know, a lot of the genitalia was extracted by Gurney when he did his revision. And so I was like, you know, looking at all that too. So that was a cool little historical refresh on that. But probably in the last 5 years, I have sent out a loan of some Spreedus to researchers. I guess we'll won't spoil anything, but we sent it off to them and they were going to try to extract DNA out of them. I don't know that that has gone anywhere, though, from several conversations. I think it got put on the back burner. However, myself and Lacey Knowles at the University of Michigan have gotten an NSF grant in the last 2 years, I guess, and it's a long-term goal. But we are going to do population-level genetic, basically a population-level phylogeny of all North American melanoplans. And there are over 600 plus species. So we're talking North America, you know, Canada, US, Mexico. And Spreedus is one we're going to have to deal with. The problem is most everything we're collecting in ethanol. And so Lacey and I have to figure out, are we, you know, unless we find some, are we going to get them out of the glacier? Are we going to try to extract out of dried specimens? But that does present a problem because everything else is going to be out of fresh material.
If I could just jump in for 1 second, I want you just alluded to, like, if you're going to go get some of these Spreedus specimens, and you mentioned being interested in the end of Lockwood's book where he sort of mysteriously alludes to the idea that he saw some weird looking grasshoppers that Jurassic Park style, he believes are the Rocky Mountain. What do you think of that? Like, do you buy that? Do you think it is lurking out there somewhere? Or
I've been. It's funny. So back in 2000, so Dan Oddie, who is, you know, probably one of the most globally recognized orthopterists he's at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, and was one of my grasshopper mentors. He still thinks it's out there, And in fact, in 2000, during the COVID year, he and Lacey Knowles and myself and some other folks went on an expedition to Wyoming, Idaho, and Nevada to some smaller mountain ranges that there are very few grasshopper records from, in part just to get out because it was COVID and we were going to get out somewhere remote and collect, and Dan needed to get out of the house by himself. And so, but also to look for the Rocky Mountain locust. And so we focused in on that group and had a great time. It was a great expedition. I had just spent 2 weeks in South Texas collecting grasshoppers and came back to Mississippi for 2 days before we left. And I was cold here in Mississippi in August. And then we go, you know, within a day and a half's drive, and I'm sleeping on the Continental Divide, freezing to death because I didn't got acclimated to the heat. And Dan Oddie's out there sleeping under the stars on a cot and a Navajo blanket, and that's all he has. And I'm like in a tent bundled up. But yeah, we did 8 days of camping all throughout the Rockies with the goal of looking for Spreetus and collecting sanguinipedes looking things. And I'll be honest with you, I haven't even gotten around to looking at the specimens we
yet. Oh, no. So I mean, it might be there, in there. So,
yeah, and I just haven't had time to look. But we did collect a lot of sanguinipedes, you know, looking things, Bruneri, Borealis, all things there in that sanguinipedes group. But yeah, I think everything that Lacey collected went in ethanol, and I don't know that Dan's looked at the specimens he got either. So I'll probably pull them out here pretty soon and look, especially after looking at those Spreetus specimens yesterday. It got me kind of interested again. So Dan thinks is there. And then, you know, thinking back after reading the book and based on what I know about other melanopus, it's just weird to me that it wouldn't be there, because most everything in that group, especially sanguinipedes, femur rubrum, all the closely related species there, they aren't like great habitat specialists. Like, you know, they're like Spreetus, or sanguinipedes rather, excuse me, occurs in disturbed, you know, just kind of ruderal places. Femur rubrums, the old fields. None of them are like, oh, we need these pristine habitats. It's kind of like just a ruderal species group. And in fact, most long-winged melanopus are that way. So melanopus, you have short-winged species that are brachypterous and don't fly, and then you have the long-winged species. There's a handful of long-winged melanopus that tend to like very specific habitat parameters, but a lot of them are just generalist, are like kind of waste places. And especially everything related to Spreetus is that way. And if you think about the swarming behavior, they certainly ate whatever and can eat whatever. So, and that tends to hold true for a lot of those long-winged melanopus like sanguinipedes. So it's just weird to me that they weren't there. And then on our trip to the Rockies, it's not like there's not habitat there. There's tons of rangeland, and rangeland should be fine for sanguinipedes was there. You get, you know, elsewhere, there's still the really conservative melanopus around. All the short wing things that require sort of specific habitat parameters, they're still there. You know, the ones we would call rare, they're still there and not that hard to find. And then there's a whole suite of grasshoppers. You know, there's a pretty well-established grasshopper community there. So I feel like it still should be there. It's not like, I mean, unless it really only inhabited the valleys, which just doesn't really make sense to me. Because when you do get in those valleys in the Rockies, like, yeah, it's just ag, just, you know, row crop from the edge of the mountain to the edge of the next mountain. But, you know, it's like the ivory-billed woodpecker. I mean, we kind of know, you know, there's only certain spots it could be. I mean, just the Rocky Mountain locust, it feels like there should still be plenty of habitat for it out there. You know, and maybe the kicker is that it does look a lot like sanguinipedes unless you look at the genitalia. So I don't know. That's my bit there. So
no, that's perfect.
So I think it could still be there. Why it hasn't done its thing, it's, you know, I don't know. But it is a very interesting mystery, that is for sure.
not going to lie. I'm going to be really excited if in 4 to 5 years you come out based on this and say, no, it's here. We have specimens. We found it. I'm going to be so pumped.
I just had them. I just didn't have time because I was busy being a professor.
I do have to ask, though, you mentioned that there are grasshopper researchers out there, and it makes sense that there would be because it's rangelands and there's lots of grasshopper issues in rangelands.
That's
he's
right.
Just, if they are there, has just nobody bothered to, like, you get a specimen in hand and say it's sanguinipes and nobody's looked at genitalia? Like, you'd think that somebody would have found one at some point.
And that's the other thing that kind of I thought about. There was a researcher in Wyoming for a long time, Dr. Fadat, that, you know, wrote a guide to grasshoppers of Wyoming in the West. And I feel like he was certainly capable of identifying it. There's a guy in Nebraska, Matthew Bruss, that is a great grasshopper researcher. And, you know, I think he would be able to key in on that as well. So there has been a lot of rangeland stuff done. But a lot of people may not be pulling the genitalia and look at them because sanguinipes is awfully abundant and it would be easy to overlook something. But
yeah, like if you have to look through 1,000 sanguinipes to find the one Rocky Mountain locust, like you get through 500 and say, well, that's all there is and stop.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it's not Spreeda's because it's gone
or
not expecting it. It would be very easy to just call them sanguinipes for sure.
I could see me doing that, getting complacent because they are quote unquote are extinct.
Right. Yeah. But as it is an intriguing mystery, and hopefully the next few years we'll shine some light on it. Maybe we can get some DNA work going on them.
You mentioned the glaciers. Perhaps are you thinking about planning an expedition to go get some frozen locusts? Do you have? In the book, Lockwood mentions like a lot of these glaciers are receding. And
that's right.
I mean, I just heard an NPR bit yesterday on glaciers receding.
Yeah.
And it's been 20 years. Like, are there still places you could go find frozen locusts?
I actually am not well versed in that, but I've talked to people that have been in the area and it sounds like they're still there and accessible. I think it's something we should definitely do before we can't do it at all. And it's not an option. I'm not looking forward to it.
I'll go.
I'm from the South and I love the heat, but I'll do it if I have to. But yeah, so, and I've talked to Lacey and like I said, we just haven't kind of honed in on how we want to handle this species yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
So do you think there's something about their biology? Like, are they more sensitive? Is that why they're not showing up in the places you would expect them to?
Yeah, I don't know. That's what kind of boggles me about it is because most of these species, that the closely related species to it, are not hard to find. I could go out, you know, if it was summer, I could go out to an edge of a roadside, you know, anywhere in Mississippi or edge of a row crop field or something like that, and collect, you know, as many sanguinipes as I wanted. Femur rubrum the same way, go to an old field and get them. Melampus mexicanus further south, that's closely related to it. You know, same thing, just, you know, rangeland or something.
Yeah, so, I'm thinking about, you know, just, the
range. Most things in Melanopus, we think about things in terms of species groups because it's such a large genus. There's over 400 species in the genus Melanopus. And they are apparently all very recently speciated. We're talking Pleistocene, post-Pleistocene in terms of their radiation. So things in these species groups are really closely related, and ecologically they tend to behave the same way, things within a species group. So that's why it just boggles my mind so much that we haven't just stumbled upon Spreeda's, because it seems like, I mean, from my eye when I was out there, there should still be habitat for it out there.
Right. Unless they all went like parthenogenic and there's no males.
Yeah. Yeah. If they went that. Yeah. But
so then could we speculate, like, if they are out there, something happened or something changed that just doesn't get them to transition into the migratory form then? Like, because they obviously haven't done that in 100 years.
Yeah. So that would be the obvious answer. Yeah. That conditions haven't been right or whatever to trigger. If they behave like other locusts, nothing has caused their population levels to get high enough to transition into the locust phase.
If you could find them though, that would be, you could do some interesting experiments where you kind of redo the, you know, touch them with a paintbrush, put them in a cage and make them eat their own poop experiments to see, like, can you get them to retransition to the migratory phase?
Right.
Or is that, did something happen and there was a genetic bottleneck and that was lost? Could that have happened too?
Right. And so there is a hypothesis out there that it was a migratory form of Sanguinipes that we drove to extinction through sort of the ways Lockwood expressed. And so that population that had the genes to transition into the migratory phase was driven to extinction. Again, that's not based on what I know presently. That's not something I agree with. But so that there was that kind of idea. Or, you know, maybe that happened with Spiritus too. Maybe we knocked out that population somehow. But reading Lockwood's book now, it did dawn on me, like, how many of these things? I mean, it seemed like we didn't make a dent in it. We killed a lot of those things, it sounds like. Just reading all the mechanisms they use to kill them and all the poisons they put out. But I still think, I mean, you know, we haven't done that to Schistocerca gugaria over in, you know, the old world over, you know, thousands of years. I'm sure we've been killing them and there's been locust, you know, they have huge teams of locust researchers out there and they haven't managed to knock that one out yet. Interestingly, I just thought about this years ago. I reviewed a paper of Lockwood's for a journal, and I've never gone back to see if it was published or not, but he brought up the idea of, if we did find it, would it be an endangered species, or because of its ag significance, would we say, no, you can't do that? Sort of that debate, would we protect it or not?
That's a very interesting question, for sure.
There was no answer in the paper. It was a philosophical thing, but...
Or even try to wipe it out. Like,
right.
It hasn't erupted in 100 years, but we want to make sure it never does.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's interesting. But also, Sanguinipes itself is known to swarm. I mean, it's the common name is the migratory grasshopper. And I was just reading through the other day and found a paper from the 50s talking about swarms of Sanguinipes and how they flew and all that. And they just don't reach the levels of Spiritus. And it's not like when they reach that swarm phase that their genitalia structure changes. So I don't know why we would think that it was a form of Sanguinipes, really. So, yeah.
That would be pretty metal if to be a locust, you had to transform your genitalia as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess one of my follow-up questions is, you've described going on expeditions and it seems like you live a pretty cool life. Jody and I are extension entomologists, and I can honestly say I've never been on an extension expedition. Jody, have you?
We do not live cool lives. Like, we've been in houses with a billion bed bugs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We've been covered in weird stuff. We receive scabs in the mail, things like that. Mike, you've been on expeditions, right?
Yeah, as a grad student, I went down to Costa Rica to get some stuff.
That's pretty cool. I guess that what I'm leading up to here is this why you got into grasshoppers? Is because it lends itself to expedition type activities? Or I'm just curious how somebody lands themselves in the grasshopper world.
Well, it's probably not that exciting. So when I was an undergraduate, I worked in a lab, and I highly recommend anyone that's going into science or, you know, maybe some other field, when you're an undergraduate, try to get a job in a lab somewhere or working with a professor, because my life would have probably turned out really differently had I not. But I was working in a lab, and the postdoc that I worked with said, hey, if you want to do your own project of some sort, come up with an idea and I'll kind of help, you know, nurture you through it. And from Mississippi, and I'd come up to Starkville, Mississippi. I was raised about 100 miles south of here. And And I got up here and I started hearing about these prairies. I was like, prairies in Mississippi? What? You know, it's not something you typically associate it with.
Okay.
And so, and yes, we have blackland prairies here in Mississippi, and they're extremely rare plant community now. We've lost 99% of them since the 1830s. But being a nature nerd, got out there and actually saw some remnants and was just blown away by the plant community. The soils are crazy different. And I was like, I want to do something with these. And the guy I worked with he was a specialist in tritrophic level interactions. So I was like, well, we'll do something with plants. And he's like, you should do something with insects because they're easy to study. And so I thought, well, spiders. And then we needed an herbivore. So grasshoppers seemed easy. So I got Dan Oddie's books out of the library and Matt Dakin's book, Orthoptera of Alabama, and started working, learning the grasshoppers. And I would come over to the entomology museum here to, you know, verify my specimens and all that. And, you know, just got, I don't know, somewhere working through the spiders and the grasshoppers. The grasshoppers just kind of stuck. And Dan's books are the Grasshoppers of North America, volumes 1 and 2 are great. He has these great watercolor paintings of the grasshoppers in them, and it was just easy to use. And interestingly, for Mississippi, there wasn't a lot known about the fauna. So I had some places I could contribute, and they sort of stuck. And while I was over here one day trying to identify my specimens, Dr. Richard Brown, the director at the time, said, "Hey, you want to go to grad school?" And I was like, "Sure." I didn't have anything else going on. I was getting close to graduation. I was a wildlife major. And so he had an assistantship to work on ants. And I said, "Sure." And so I had changed my major 3 times, and I had well over 200 undergraduate course hours. And so I found the interdisciplinary science degree option, and I was able to meld all of my coursework into a cohesive degree and graduate that semester. They're like, "Yeah, you've got an assistantship waiting on you. You got plenty of hours. Let's get you out of here." And so I started working on ants, but Richard was always gracious enough to let me still work on grasshoppers. I would curate the collection and, you know, was always out in the field working, you know, collecting ants and whatnot, and would always collect grasshoppers too. And in the process of working on ants, I was up in the Smokies working on the ATBI there, and just happened to mention one day Matt Dakin's name, because I thought Matt was dead. He had written the Orthoptera of Alabama in the 70s, and someone had told me he was dead. But then I found out he was doing the Orthoptera there for the ATBI for the Smokies. And so they put me in touch with him, and he's lived over in Auburn, Alabama. And within a few months, he came over and started, you know, working with me, training me on grasshoppers. And actually, he's the one that taught me how to extract the genitalia, because before that, I just kind of ignored melanopus, like, because I'd always heard they were hard. You got to look at the genitalia. I know how to do that. So he taught me how to extract the genitalia and identify them that way. And somewhere along the line, Tommy Allen, who used to be at the University of Arkansas, did a lot of stuff in the Interior Highlands. He had moved to the Academy of Natural Sciences at Philadelphia and knew Dan Oddie well, but it also turns out that Tommy Allen was Richard Brown's master's advisor, and they were still pretty close. And Tommy would come down and hang out at our museum here at Mississippi State for a while. And he was always like the crazy uncle that would come to town or whatever. He would come in and joke around and stir stuff up and then leave. But it was always a blast to have him around. But he was my in with Dan Oddie. And so I could go up to the academy, and Tommy would get me in with Dan, and Dan would look over my material and whatnot. And it wasn't long, probably around 2009, Dan came down to work on the Melanopus scutteri group. And we were corresponding, and I said, "Hey, when you come down, why don't hook up with me and I'll show you around the South." And we did that. And by the end of the trip, he had given me the scutteri group to work on for my PhD work. And it was a fabulous group, described 21 new species of grasshoppers from the Southeast. And Dan and I are still friends. And it blows me away to this day that the two books that I learned grasshoppers from, the North American grasshoppers and the Orthoptera of Alabama, that I was able to meet those people, the authors of those books, and learn from them. And now I am helping Dan write the third volume of Grasshoppers in North America. Just That's blows me away that I've been that lucky in life to be able to do that. Just some dude from, you know, Mississippi, like.
I understand that feeling for sure.
And even more so, it blows me away that I am now director of the Mississippi Entomological Museum. And I've never left Mississippi State. Like, but it's cool because I feel like I'm playing for the hometown team, right? And I want us, Mississippi gets a bad rap a lot of times, but I want us to have one of the best entomology collections around, which, you know, in the grand scheme of life, maybe is not that big a deal, but it is to me. So
it's important to you. And I would say from a Kentucky perspective, we look up to you, the Mississippi Museum in particular. We hold you all in high regard. It seems like a really well-run machine there. It sounds like getting into the Orthoptera world is almost like the mafia. Like you had to get introductions. There were people who you thought were dead, but then they weren't. It sounds very mysterious. So maybe people that are listening, if you're looking for a taxonomic group with some spy type of lure, maybe this is the one for you.
Yeah, but it's amazing that more people don't work on grasshoppers, because Dan likes to say this too, is that they're just out there. You just go get them. They're, you know, it's not like ants where you're sitting, putting down bait or doing Berlese litter sampling, or moths where you're blacklighting, or beetles putting up, you know, pitfall traps or whatever. You just get a net and you just go get them. You know, it's a little more complicated than that, where you're, you know, when you're tracking down specific things and you're looking for, you know, certain habitat requirements or whatever. But it's just where it is. You know, new employee Ray Fisher, got him helping me collect grasshoppers in the last year, and he's a mite expert. But he got out there and started helping me, and he's like, man, grasshoppers are where it's at. He's like, this is fun. You know, he's like, we're just out here collecting stuff. I'm like, yeah. So yeah, grasshoppers are fun. That's my
that's your pitch.
I think that's a great story. That's interesting. It's a very interesting story.
Do you have some perspective on why people maybe don't join the grasshopper world? Because yeah, to me, it seems like maybe I would always perceive it as like a well-colonized hill. Like grasshoppers are big, they're easy to catch. Is it the difficulty in taxonomic differentiation, or what spooks people away?
I think there was some of that. So a lot of people assume that they're well-known. And in fact, you know, the slant face or the bandwing species are largely well-known. There's still some, you know, taxonomy to be done there. But the melanopus, I think what held it back so long is that you do need to extract the genitalia. And there are a lot of them that superficially look alike. And so it does require that genitalia examination. But that's the exciting thing. There's still a lot to be discovered out there from the eastern U.S., southeastern U.S. in the last 7 years. I've described now 30 new species of grasshoppers from the eastern U.S. That's right here in our own backyard. The first grasshopper I ever described was Melanopus ingrami from Cedar Glades right outside of Nashville. Now, these Cedar Glades there are, they're full of rare endemic plants that only occur in just a couple counties in central Tennessee. These glades have been studied by biologists since the 1800s because of these rare, cool plants. Literally, the first step I ever took in one of those glades, I stepped out of the car, grasshopper jumps up. Oh my God, what is that? Never seen anything like it before. New species. And that's like literally right outside of Nashville, Tennessee, and indeed a rare plant community, one that biologists have worked in, but it just took the right person to see it. And that grasshopper was all over those glades. But as a short-winged melanopus, does not disperse well, and very specific requirements. So it only occurs there in those few counties. But there's still a lot of that left to find here in the eastern U.S. And in fact, most of the species that I've described have come from these rare grassland communities that are considered in peril here in the southeast.
So a lot of these a lot of these grasshoppers then that you're finding and describing, like, are they, you describe them and they're immediately endangered or threatened because they're coming from these kind of rare habitats?
Yeah, they could probably be, most of them could probably be listed that way. You know, none of them are at present, but they could probably be at least, if you're familiar with conservation rankings, be anywhere between a S1 and S2, something like, or S3, maybe some of them. But yeah, one that I have impressed right now, in fact, is only known from one sand ridge in central Florida that, you know, spans two counties, but it's just a narrow sliver of those counties. And it's doing okay. In fact, that one is well protected because it's on a bombing range at an Air Force base. But the fire, in fact, the fire from the munitions explosions keep that habitat suitable for that species. But yeah, that's the only place in the world where that grasshopper occurs is this one little sand ridge in central Florida, which that is not uncommon in Florida. Florida has more grasshopper species than any state in the eastern U.S. So
that's there's got to be something there about a grasshopper that only survives because it's in a bombing range. So you mentioned earlier in this interview the different, there's long wing melanopolis and short wing melanopolis, and you've said that the short wings don't disperse very well, and that you've described a lot of species. So can we kind of synthesize all that? Do you want to talk a bit about what's going on? Are all these new species coming from all these new species coming from these short wing groups? What's going on with melanopolis in North America that you're finding all these new species? Because 30 new species of grasshopper seems like a lot.
Yeah, well, back in, let's see, what was it, 2012, Dan Oddie published a paper, 80 new species of melanopus from, you know, North America. And that was kind of just a big, you know, spitting out of new species. There wasn't a lot of synthesis there. But just trying to get all that knocked out of the way in preparation for the third volume. But yeah, so most of those are coming out of these brachypterous or short wing groups that don't fly well and have limited distributions. Here in the Southeast, they seem to have diversified. So, that, you know, all of these are grassland species. And during the Pleistocene, we would have been a lot drier here in the Southeast. And our streams, because, right, the water was locked up in the ice. And so our streams were much smaller, our rivers were much smaller, species could move across them. Post-Pleistocene or during some of the interglacial periods, it got wetter here in the Southeast, grasslands shrunk, more trees were able to come in, and our waterways got bigger with associated flood streams, so it isolated the populations. And so they split that way. In the Rockies, a lot of the short-winged species are alpine specialists. So during periods of glaciation or whatever, they could come down and expand their ranges, maybe come in contact. But as that recedes, they get pushed farther up the mountains and isolated. So they're in sky islands. And so every little peak or within a range, maybe, they got isolated. And because they rely on genitalia for species differentiation, they're under high sexual selection, which causes things to speciate rapidly. So yeah, you get all these isolated populations, and under sexual selection, they can speciate.
You mentioned a lot of this, or at least some of the speciation is post-glaciation. So some of these things are like 8,000-10,000 year old species.
Really rapid. Yeah. And Lacey Knowles puts forward that it's, when we're done with it, it's going to probably rival that of, you know, African cichlids or maybe Hawaiian Drosophila. So
that's really cool that like that kind of system was just kind of hiding,
yeah,
under everybody's nose. I guess I say hiding, were orthopterists generally aware like this was probably like this, or is it becoming more clear?
It's becoming more though. I mean, Lacey published her Rocky stuff in the early, you know, 2000s. So yeah, it was kind of known. And then we had a paper, I guess, the last couple of years about some of the Southeastern stuff. And I think once we get it together with all this population level sampling we're doing now and pull it together in a big thing, I think it's going to be pretty cool.
So what are some of this is totally off topic, but what are the coolest places that you've been? Like if you could go back and go there. Or you can say, like, why, what are the top things that we must see if we were to come to Mississippi?
Oh, Mississippi? Well, I would take you to a prairie probably, because that's not something most people see, even people that live here, right? Here in the South, we kind of, people don't think about our grasslands. You know, I have a friend that when he's talking about our grasslands, he likes to talk about the squirrel story. So there's this old tale, not sure the origins of it, where a squirrel could go from the Mississippi River to the Atlantic Ocean and never touch the ground because, you know, it was forested. Well, that's not the case. And we know that now through multiple things, from historical notes, from just the biology. I mean, most of the rare species in the Southeast, you know, that are listed or whatever, tend to occur in grasslands, the plants and those things. Some of our larger mammals or birds, maybe not, but so I would take you to a prairie probably. And like I said, we've lost 99% of them. It would probably blow you away. They're called blackland prairies, but most of our good deep black soil prairies are gone. So what's left is the bedrock, which is this white Cretaceous age chalk. It's not limestone. It's a chalk, just like you would write on a chalkboard with. And you can find these massive oyster shells, the genus Exogyra, which is an extinct genus of oyster, shark teeth, whatever. And that soil is why we have grasslands here, because it has a really high shrink swell capacity. It's made out of the exoskeletons of microplankton, basically. And so in the summer, it get huge cracks in it because it'll dry out. In fact, my house, the doors don't close right half the year because the high shrink swell capacity of these soils. And in the winter, they swell with water and swell back shut. But so that's really hard for trees to grow in. But eastern red cedar will invade them. And so they're there for because of the soil, but fire maintains them. So they're really cool ecosystems, and plants you don't see elsewhere in the state, plants you would associate with the Great Plains. So take you to that, maybe the coast, see some longleaf pine savanna. That would be cool. Yeah, but in the Southeast in general, there's tons of stuff to see. Roan Mountain, my God, go there. It's like the opening scene from The Sound of Music. It's just amazing. We have some really cool grasslands, but Florida is my favorite place to go, not because of Disney World or the beaches, but because of the scrub habitat that most people would probably find annoying. You know, scrubby oaks that would tear your legs up, but that's grasshopper heaven to me. So,
grasshopper heaven is a good band name. I think I still that one. So it sounds like a pretty interesting road to get to be in the grasshopper world. You've seen lots of cool stuff. What are some cool projects that you have going on in your lab and in your work as director of the museum right now?
Yeah. So personally, working on the third volume of North American Grasshoppers with Dan. And so just going through doing a lot of revisions of groups that have been ignored for a long time. In fact, right now I'm working on a group from Texas and have six new species in it, describing it. And they're all from the Edwards Plateau in Texas. So it's pretty cool. Just a big kind of plateau in central Texas that they occur on. And again, it looks like rivers are separating those. So working on that, the project with Lacey. And then I do lots of other things because I'm interested in grasslands. But here in the museum, like I said, I want us to be the best. So I have this problem of not saying no. And also, so before I was a tenure track professor, I was a research professor. So I was on soft money, which meant I had to hustle for a dollar. And also a reason I didn't say no, because I wanted a job. And so myself and our lab manager here in the museum, who's also my wife, she was in the same boat as myself. And so we started, largely, she was the driver for our outreach program, Mississippi Bug Blues. And we work a lot with the underserved communities here in Mississippi and the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians. We do a lot with them. But at present, we have, I think, 32 funded projects. And we have about 50 employees, including most of that is a large army of student workers. But yeah, we do a lot here. But I think we have 13 full-time staff members. So we do a lot of things from pollinator conservation, straight up just biological inventories, some ecological projects. We diversify a lot. here. So,
can we talk more about Mississippi bug blues? That's something I've always kind of been enamored with from afar. It seems like a really cool program. What was sort of the genesis of that? And then where can people find it? I know you have a Facebook page and things. Could people check out more about it there?
Yeah. So, in fact, some of the impetus started with Kentucky, actually, with Janet. So Jennifer and Janet, who's at the University of Kentucky there with you, they became friends, and Janet was mentioned that they do some outreach and that they got the money through what at the time was the Farm Bill. And so I think Jennifer decided to go that route as well here for Mississippi. And we were able to partner with a local science group that worked in the schools here, sort of additional. They were providing additional science learning here. And so we were able to get in with them, and it's really just grown. So now we do, you know, the kind of the standard tabling events where you take your, you know, your bugs and your literature to tables, to, you know, garden shows and state fairs, things like that. But we now have our own curriculums. We have what we call Field Trip Fridays. So every Friday during the school year, we have usually around 40 fourth graders or fifth graders, depending on the semester, that come to the department here, and we'll basically get a tour of the museum. We set up stations, so they get things on exotic pests, medical veterinary entomology, you know, whatever, just large variety of things. But, you know, a lot of our funding comes from USDA. So we push home the idea of, you know, pest, and we have games that we developed where they learn the words import, export, and they take and have sort of like a commodity, maybe coffee or something like that, that they're transporting from Brazil to the US. And then they open it up and it says, you know, your coffee, you know, some ants were found in your coffee. What do you do with it? You know, things like that. Uh-huh. But they actually have to get up and move and like transport it to, you know, somewhere else in the classroom. So it gets them moving and gets them thinking about things and what import and export mean, native, exotic, you know, invasive. We teach them all those keywords. But we also, because biodiversity is so close to my heart, that we also have some grants that let us do that kind of work. And we do a lot of that work with the Choctaw Indian tribe here in Mississippi. We started the Mississippi State Insect Fair, where third graders from around the state come here for a week of insect immersion, basically. Do a lot of that. So yeah, we've expanded a lot. We have a full-time outreach coordinator now. We have a mobile museum. We took an old trailer that was just sitting behind the building.
Awesome.
And got a little grant to rehab it. And we happened to have an employee that was great at woodworking, and he made us flexible displays so we can, you know, change them out routinely, and we can take that trailer and make it a mobile museum, a kind of like a tiny museum sort of idea. And, you know, we may hang up traps, lingering funnels or whatever, and have displays on emerald ash borer, or we might switch it out and change it to spotted lanternfly, or maybe butterfly diversity. Something, you know, just depends on what the venue is looking for. So
that sounds amazing. An amazing opportunity for people down in Mississippi. I wish we could bring you up to Kentucky or maybe out to Nebraska. It seems like it'd be a good fun time for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we have traveled some. We did an event in Texas last year. So
Texas, they get all the good stuff. It sounds like a lot of exciting work is going on down there. Are you part of this is maybe something we could edit out, but like the Moth Photographers Group, that's part of the Mississippi Museum, right?
So sort of. We host it on our museum server here at Mississippi State. And that was largely, I think, in part because of my predecessor, Dr. Richard Brown, who was a lepidopterist. And personally, I don't have a lot to do with it other than signing the permission forms for people to access it to do the updates and whatnot. But it is something we absolutely are happy to have. And in fact, I've been told many times that it is the most visited site on the MSU webpage or servers, I think. So yeah. And Richard is still very active, and we've had a lot of graduate students over the years that have helped sort of develop that in various ways.
Very cool.
This has been a really great interview. Thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I was glad to be here. Yeah, and I really liked y'all's podcast name too, by the way.
Thank you. We always talk. We can't believe nobody had taken it.
Yeah.
Still on the market. Well, it was a very exciting interview. We appreciate your time. It was exciting to learn about where Rocky Mountain locust science still stands today. Maybe Lockwood's book isn't quite as out of date as we had previously made some assumptions about, and to hear about some of your adventures and what's going on down in Mississippi, a place that is underappreciated and under talked about, I would argue. So thanks for joining us. If the folks online would like to share any ideas or thoughts about the show, you can always find it at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. You can also find the show on Twitter, arthro_podshow. We are also on all of your favorite podcatcher apps. We're on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts. Make sure you type in arthro-pod to find us. And if you like the show, we always appreciate a rating or a review so more people can find us. If you want to find me online, I'm at BugmanJohn.
I'm at Jody Bugsme, UNL.
And I'm at mscavarla36.
We hope you enjoyed today, and we are excited to be jumping into 2023. We're going to be bringing you another couple dozen podcasts this year, and we're excited, and hopefully you will join us for all of them. We'll see you the next time.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod Gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.